This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
No, don't cut this out. I want to prove that Brock doesn't know everything.
And Brock Rom.
And I'm going to get up on my elitist cinema soapbox here for a hot second.
I thought it was called an apple box. Welcome to episode 9. This one's all about equipment, and we're going to get into our podcast setup, the 180 degree rule, and of course, talk about cameras.
3, 2, 1, clap. Close enough.
No, that was not good.
Well, you can tell we've been off for a little bit because that was pretty poor. It was the beginning of a slow clap. We would have gotten in sync eventually.
Hey, what's going on? It's Justin. Just wanted to give a shout out to APM for providing the track for us here on the Creative Sports Podcast. We're doing this podcast as an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're finding us and aren't a member of the community yet, you can sign up for free at sportscreativeslack.com.
All right, so we're here to talk about equipment today, and I got a request from Alex Geiger, who is interested in knowing a little bit more behind the scenes of the podcast, recording, setup, how we got everything up and running. So I think that's probably a great place to start. We're open to starting that conversation and sharing everything that we've learned along the way here. So I know Brock is really the resident equipment expert in this group. So I wanted to toss it over to him first to start out with his setup, because he definitely has the best setup out of all of us.
Yeah, thanks. So the big thing about recording a podcast remotely is we all connect through Zoom just like we would any meeting. And we could just record the audio through there and just call it good. But obviously Zoom has some limitations. It compresses the audio, you know, to a smaller bit rate. So there's a lot of fidelity lost. Even though you can record stuff out to multi-track, you know, it's not ideal. So every single one of us has a microphone with either an audio DAC, like what I have. It's not really a DAC. It is a DAC. Digital analog conversion. Mine is just a Scarlett 2i2. It's got two little combo XLR TRS jacks that I plug into, and then that is my audio device for Zoom. And then I open up Audition and I record my input there as well. So we clap at the beginning, which is funny because we kind of don't really need to. But that's so we can sync and post. So we all record our own audio. Justin is usually the one who edits it. Although we're all going to start editing a little bit more to take that off him, but you sync it with the Zoom audio and post, or you line up the claps, or however you want to sync audio. You can do it literally like you do with video, like with Pluralize, which Pluralize isn't really a thing anymore, or just, you know, Adobe's, you know, audio synchronization. And then you have raw tracks, we each record uncompressed waves or AFs, and push those over to whomever, usually Justin, who's editing the episode. On my setup's a little bit more robust, simply because I used to, in college, some friends and I helped run a recording studio in Lincoln called Plan C Recordings. So I have a lot of audio gear that I've amassed over the years that's just kind of like sat in my basement. So my microphone is an EV Electro Voice RE20, which is kind of radio broadcast standard. It's also a really good vocal mic for vocalists, and it's also like a really, really good kick drum mic. And sometimes you can put it on a guitar cab too, and it sounds okay. It's not my favorite guitar cab mic. But that then goes into a preamp I have that's an RNP. RNP stands for really nice preamp. And then that runs through an outboard compressor called an RNC by the same company, which stands for really nice compressor, in case you didn't get the naming convention there. And then I run line out of that into my Scarlett 2i2. Why I do that is because I like the way the preamp sounds better than the Scarlett's preamp. And I like the way the RNC compressor outboard sounds than the built-in compressors I personally own. It definitely sounds better than the built-in compressor in Audition or Premiere. But yeah, that's kind of my setup. And I know Justin and Garrett kind of have a little different variation of that too.
Well, no, that's pretty close to what I've got going on. I think we're in about the same boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm losing it over because Garrett's face the whole time.
I couldn't tell if Justin was trying to laugh that entire time or
I could keep a straight face. Sorry. Garrett was shaking his head the whole time. I had no idea.
I will say, I know we laugh about it, but I honestly do believe, and the one thing I instill to when I was at Notre Dame, students and people who worked for me is, if you don't know audio, go learn audio, because audio is the most important part of video. Anybody who tells you different is lying and doesn't know what they're talking about. So if you don't know what compression is, if you don't know how preamps work, if you don't know things like noise floor and signal to noise ratio, just go look up tutorials right now, because it's good audio versus bad audio can make or break a piece.
Now that is something that I will wholeheartedly agree with.
Yeah, Brock, I think one of the things that you mentioned, the TRRS plug is an important one to identify, because the four rings are important for audio and the mic.
Right, that's on a combo. Yeah, so for those who don't know, TRRS is just it's tip, ring, ring, sleeve. So when you have a TRS versus a TRRS jack, tip, ring, sleeve is usually just audio only. And generally it's balanced. Balanced is usually what you want. Because balanced cables have better shielding and they don't have interference. An example of an unbalanced cable would be like, I guess TRS cables, headphone jacks can be unbalanced, and they usually are. But thicker quarter inch TRS are usually balanced. Like old RCA cables that you used to plug up to your DVD player, for anybody who's old enough to remember DVD players, those are unbalanced. So like if you ran that next to like a power supply, you'd get noise in there, right? Whereas a balanced cable is shielded better and will mitigate that noise, and that's why balanced cables are thicker, right? Because they have more shielding. But yeah, TRS is just tip, ring, sleeve. Those are just the separate connectors, right? When you plug in a headphone jack or you plug in a quarter inch jack and you hear the like click, 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 that's what you're hearing. You're hearing the tip, the ring, and the sleeve essentially click into place. What Justin's talking about when you have a TRRS is when you have headphone audio plus a microphone with your signal, right? So there's an extra ring, right? So that's if you ever see XLR jacks that have the little hole in the middle for a quarter inch plug, that's a TRS connector, right? Whereas your laptop or your phone, if you have a phone that still has a headphone jack somehow, they generally have TRRS ports, because you can plug in their combo jack, right? Microphone and headphone.
Yeah, I have, it's called a Siconic Smart Rig 2 that I use as that TRRS jack into my computer. And then it also has a headphone out, so that I can, it has an in for the microphone, an XLR in, and a headphone out. So I can use that as my conduit to be able to broadcast my mic into the computer so that you guys can hear me well. And then I can hear what you guys are saying through the out. But then I also run a XLR splitter to a Tascam 10X to record separately, which means I have to record in two places, but it's pretty straightforward and easy there. Brock did end up trying to show me how to do it in Audition, and I have done that for redundancy. And as Tyler Joint told me, it's the big record button,
the big red button.
But yeah, there's a little bit more to it than that. So yeah, I mean, but it's great to be able to record redundancy, and that's probably a big thing to highlight, is making sure that we have backups if necessary. If the primary source isn't something happens to it, we do have a backup so that we don't lose everything.
And what about your mic there? I know you're rocking that Rode Pod mic.
Yeah, it's not the most expensive mic in the world, but yeah, it's a Pod mic from Rode. So yeah, it works great.
I do like that Rode Pod mic. My EV, I bought it used, but my EV is usually like a $600 microphone new, like $400 to $600. I bought it used and refurbished, so I got it much, much cheaper than that. But the Pod mic is a good alternative. Rode also makes another microphone that I really, really like that's an RE20 copy that's just called the Rode Podcaster or the Rode Procaster. I think the Procaster is a recorder. I don't know. It's really hard to tell Rode's product line sometimes, but it's the Rode Procaster. It's essentially an RE20 copy for like $200, and it sounds like 90% of the way there. So like there are, you know, don't think you have to go out and spend a bunch of money. You know, I think Justin's setup sounds really, really good at the fraction of what a brand new, you know, EV RE20 would cost.
Yeah, I think everything I listed here was under $250 total.
Yeah.
So it's reasonable. Plus my $12 mic stand, which is something you can't replace. It doesn't look as pretty as your table mounted one, but you know, I was going for executing on the podcast and bringing my sweet pipes to the airwaves here more than spending a lot of money.
The beauty of audio is so much of the input side is analog, and that means that it doesn't move in the way the camera industry does, right? Where it's like there's a new camera next year, Red has their new sensor out, and it's totally different, right? This RE20 has been the industry standard since like the 70s, you know. Same with like a Shure SM7B is like a similar microphone. It's famous for being the Michael Jackson Thriller microphone, right? Like it's just been around forever, and people still use it in the same capacity. Now the DACs, the conversions, things like that change. But on the analog side things, if you buy a nice mic, you know, early on, whether that's like a field shotgun mic for recording audio or a podcast mic or something, you can, you know, you can use that for years to come, and it's not going to become obsolete. It's kind of like buying glass for cameras, right? The body and the sensor might change, but if you buy some really nice, you know, cine lenses or, you know, some L series photo lenses, they're going to work. People still use like Canon FD lenses all the time from back in the 80s and 90s on stuff today, because that kind of like non-digital analog aspect to it all doesn't age. You know, it might change in preference or timbre or color or things like that, but it's not going to stop working, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can speak to that. My recording setup is a little older itself. It is a old shotgun mic from a camera combined with a beautiful nondescript XLR going into a Zoom recorder. So I'm really, really keeping it simple on my end. Definitely the less technological of our three audio setups, but it's treated me well. I really think the secret sauce for me is that I live in Chicago and have a small apartment I share with my wife, who's also working from home, and I record in my closet. So I think that is really what makes this audio setup special on my end is the, you know, the sound dampening that I get from all the clothes.
Like, it's funny, but it's actually true. My room is not very well treated for audio because I'm in my basement here in South Bend. And my floor is a solid floor. It's not carpet or anything. There's a bunch of 90 degree angles and just like open drywall. So it's pretty echoey in here. You know, so Garrett really probably has the best sound isolation out of all of this. When I do finally move to Austin, I'm probably going to, you know, maybe do a little bit of sound treatment. You know, and sound treatment doesn't have to be anything crazy. You can literally do what Garrett does, which is like just record in a closet, or you can put up moving blankets, a really good alternative, on some C-stands, and you can create like a little, you know, VO booth. Or if you're in a room where you like the way it sounds, like a lot of when I was recording bands in college, a lot of it was you didn't want that like sound boothy VOE, you know, kind of isolated voiceover sound. You wanted to have the room in there in some way, shape, or form. You wanted to have a good sounding room. So you wanted something with like high ceilings and non 90 degree angles and a wood floor and things like that. But really you can, that's the nice thing about audio. You can kind of make a lot of things work for not a lot of money with what you have laying around, and still make really, really good audio depending on what you're going for.
After we take the, you know, do the recording and get everything uploaded, take it into Premiere, and do the edit, sync it up, highlight all the clips, right click, tell it to align to zoom, the zoom recording, and then we get rid of the zoom recording and knock it out. So it's pretty straightforward after that, as long as we don't have to re-record anything, which hasn't happened yet.
Not yet. Sometimes I forget to turn off my dehumidifier in the background, so we have to do a little bit of noise reduction there, but outside of that.
And Essential Sound is really great for that. The integration that Premiere has done over the last couple of releases with Audition, including the Essential Sound, Essential Graphics, and all those things, is really helps make it easy. And to be honest, the reason I'm using Premiere instead of Audition is because that's the program I'm most comfortable with, and I know I can do the same thing, but quicker in it. So that's how it works.
Yeah, and that's totally fine. And I use, you know, I have a lot of audio plugins just from what I used to do back 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, all my VST3 plugins and stuff work in Premiere. It's not like I'm losing any plugins, you know, when I go from Audition to Premiere or anything like that. The only thing that can get a little wonky in Premiere is when you're trying to, like, do finite cuts in a sequence that's like 30 frames per second, where you can only cut on a frame, right? You here's one frame, here's the other frame, and maybe the cut you want to do is in the middle of those two frames.
Yeah.
That's where Audition, you can cut on a per sample basis. But you know, what we're doing, we really don't need to be that precise, so it really doesn't matter. You also can't, you know, print effects like onto a waveform like you can in Audition, which again doesn't really matter. You're just kind of putting it on the track for it, you know, or on the individual clip, but you can't really bake it in to see what it does to the waveform, which sometimes on like noise reduction I like to do in Audition, because I like to visually see how it's affecting A, the noisy parts of the recording, and B, the waveform. Same with compression. I generally know what I want my compression settings to be, but sometimes I'll go and I'll look at a waveform and I'll be like, oh my gosh, that's way too crunchy. It just looks like a block, you know, or, oh, I didn't go enough. There's way too many dynamics there, you know, that sort of stuff. But it's not essential, right? Like, you can do all the same things that you can do in Audition in Premiere for the most part.
All right, let's get Garrett a little bit more involved here now that we've gotten through some of that equipment talk, and he can kind of run the show and ask the questions from here. But the 180 degree rule came up in the Slack channel from Zach Roberts at Ohio, and he was wondering if he has two cameras, one's up high, is it an issue if he is shooting on the far sideline, which would be their team sideline, and how to cut between those. So I thought that was a good topic to bring in here.
On my end, obviously the ideal is always to shoot on the same sideline that you've got your high cam on. If you're shooting a game, I know that was always my preference, but especially when you go into visiting stadiums, things like that, you never know where you're going to get put. And, you know, sometimes you get thrown a curveball. For me, the 180 degree rule, I don't use it as a hard and fast rule. I think it's like a great starting point. I think it's where you want to be, you know, mindful of it and use it as much as you can. But especially, you also kind of have to think about what you're going to use the footage for, right? Because if you're never going to, you know, or if it's just like a quick and dirty game highlight after the game is the only time those two are ever going to be cut together, then, you know, okay, you can probably live with breaking the 180 degree rule. And especially, you know, if you're tight with your sideline cam, you know, if you have any other angles you can cut to beyond just the, you know, one high and one low, you can kind of mix in a reverse angle there. But to me, I don't mind because I used to shoot on visiting sidelines all the time, which would be opposite the high home cam. And, you know, mix that stuff together. A, just because you kind of don't have a choice sometimes when you go on a visiting team. Like, you can be on their sideline, but if all your good sound is going to be, you know, stuff that you need to go into your home team or your team's bench box, then, you know, it doesn't do you a lot of good. You're basically sacrificing which side you're on for getting, like, the good stuff that you're actually there to capture. So, I don't know. To me, it's just, I don't think it's a hard and fast thing. I think that you need to realize that you can kind of mix in some of that stuff that you shoot low with some of the high stuff if you absolutely have to. You know, when you're in the role that Zach's at, you know, you're probably going to be using some of that low footage more for stuff later, for hype videos later on. Mm-hmm. For, you know, you're not going to be using it intercut with that high. So I think, to me, I would just ask myself, like, what is the priority for this footage I'm capturing? Is it stuff that I'm going to mix with the high cam? And if it is, then maybe you need to think about, you know, going over to the other team sideline mm-hmm. and shooting over there all game. But if your main priority with capturing this footage is to use it later on, you know, for a hype video, for a trailer, for, you know, other purposes, then I would probably just suck it up, break the 180 degree rule, try and shoot, you know, tight enough so that if you do have to intercut it with your high cam on the other side, it doesn't look disgusting, like, you know, that you're not looking like the same width and the same look, and just suck it up and realize that going tight from your sideline to get that sound is worth more to you than breaking that 180 degree rule.
I 100% agree. I was going to re-highlight the tight part of that from you, Garrett. I remember when I was with the Bears, it depends on offense and defense, right? Depends on what side you're on the field. Whenever we were on offense, I always tried to stay about 30 yards ahead of the team.
Yeah.
And if they were back in on our own 20 yard line coming forward, we had, you know, we could go up to the 35 on either side. If we weren't in the bench area, and, you know, players block you anyway if you're that close. So I always went on the far side, and when they kept on getting closer and closer, that back far corner by the pylon seemed to be a really great angle. And if you end up going just around the corner to that and you're more straight on, then that really helps eliminate anything as well, because then the player, when you switch to a camera that's running of a player running straight at you, if they're running to the end zone, if they're on offense, right, and coming in for a touchdown, that's what you want anyway, right? So it just depends on where you are in the field, but I think shooting tight and challenging yourself, it is much more challenging to shoot tight. So push yourself to shoot as tight as you can to get some of those great ISO shots, especially with football, with helmets. Anytime you can see a player's eyes, a player's facial reaction, as their excitement as they're running into the end zone or something along those lines, that's really what you're there for.
Right. And I think that, you know, we should explain why there is a 180 degree rule, right? It's because it's visually confusing to the viewer if somebody is looking and moving one way, and then in the same sequence, you cut to them looking and moving the opposite direction, right? So what I've learned a lot, I'm not going to ever claim to be a great editor or cinematographer. I love cinematography. I love shooting. I love lighting. It doesn't mean I'm great at it. I think I'm okay. It's not really what I do anymore, but I'm absolutely a huge cinematography nerd. But what I learned, primarily from Joe Dane, who's a great resource for all of this, is you want to think about the viewer's eye, and what they're doing. And if you have to make the viewer work to interpret something, like, that's not good, right? There's a really, really good video I watched one time about, I forget the director's name, the guy who directed Mad Max Fury Road, about shooting action sequences and framing them. And he was so intentional about all the action taking place center crosshair on the camera, and no thirds, rolls, whatever, just center, because he didn't want the viewer's eye to have to work during quick cuts. Right. And that really stuck with me, especially in sports. And that kind of made me think about how I frame my shots, how I edit afterwards, right? If I, even if it's not breaking 180 degree rule, if I'm going from a shot where the person with the ball is left side of the frame to a low shot where they're right side of the frame, I'm making the viewer work, moving their eye from the left side of the frame to the right side of the frame. So on those types of cuts, especially if it's something quick, I try and either crop and reframe it, or I try to find another shot, you know, that doesn't make the visual leap be too much there. Re-emphasizing, and then from a live side, there are a lot of reverse angles in live sports. But my rule is if I'm cutting to a reverse angle live, it needs to be tight enough that you can't really tell it's reverse, right? And I can't be cutting on the same subject. We have this at Notre Dame football a lot. We have a reverse 50 that shoots Notre Dame's bench. And it also is a tight pocket follow for replays. And then replays, it doesn't matter because it's slow enough. The mind can figure out what's going on when you go from, like, the only thing I would never do is I wouldn't go from like a high camera side replay to a reverse wide replay, if that makes sense. I would maybe go, you know, the other thing you have in football is a high end zone, which kind of like bridges that 180 too. So in my opinion, it's totally fine to go. I you know, in general replay sequence for me might be like high, low, or high end zone to a low end zone to a reverse, you know, something like that. Because there's something there to break it up. I don't think I'd ever go from, like, first of all, you never really show a ton of game camera replays unless you're looking at something really weird, offside, something like that. I would never go from like high game to like high reverse 50, right? That would be a little disorienting. But at Notre Dame hockey, our benches, normally when you go to a hockey, an NHL arena, or most college arenas, the benches are split. What I mean by that is on one side you have the home team, on the other side, and then there's a split in the middle, and then right next to them is the away team, right? They're all on the same side. Well, at Notre Dame, they built it so home team is on one side and the away team is on the opposite side of the ice. So we have to have a reverse slash all the time just for the sake of getting opposing team bench shots and opposing team coach shots. But we made that camera one of our supermos, and they're a tight puck follow, right? So they're always shooting tight. So there's not a ton of, I mean, yeah, you can tell they're going the other way, but in my opinion, and again, this is just my opinion, it's super subjective, I think that's easier for somebody to process, especially if you're going from like slow, tight replay, one side, slow, tight replay, the other side. And then if I ever cut it in live, I'm only ever doing it like tight faces, you know, or opposing team bench or things like that.
It's interesting. You were obviously focusing on the live element, because when you were talking, the first thing that came to mind, I've done this not very often, I don't recommend doing it, but in post you can flip the horizontal to get the guy on the left side, even though he was initially on the right side, if you're really in a pinch.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that you called out is making it easier on the viewers. So the first thing that came to my mind is in animation they call it eye trace, and when you see really good animation or motion graphics, they take you and direct you all the way through the frame, so they mm-hmm. tell you where you're supposed to look. And that's kind of the same thing here, is you're directing the viewer and helping them understand what they're supposed to be watching and telling the story that way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, another thing I've always thought is important, and Justin, you kind of alluded to it, is you're not the only camera out there, right? So what is your purpose? For me, if I know I'm getting a melt from the game, now granted it's broadcast footage, whatever, or if you're in the NFL and you have access to NFL films footage, I'm probably honestly not going to follow ball much. You know, I would want those like detail close up, try and capture a moment, take a risk and get screwed because you know you're backed up in other places. Now granted, if you're out there shooting an Aria Mira and your broadcaster shooting like Sony 4300 broadcast cameras, it's going to look different. You know, it's a 1/3 inch sensor versus a Super 35 sensor with different color profiles, right? But that stuff gets cut together all the time across the industry, unless you're like NFL films and you're rolling out, you know, 6 or 7 Amiras to your A game, right? So if you're in the NFL especially, you know, you have that up a mirror shooting for you, that tight pocket follow. You have at least two down following action for you for every single game, even a C tier game, right? So if you're out shooting NFL, you know, what are you going to get action follow wise that's going to be better than what they're going to get, you know?
Yeah.
You might capture something they miss, you know, but like they're not going to be getting, you know, your quarterback, you know, face mask right in their grill. You know, they're not going to be getting the bench stuff. If it's a C game, they're not going to have a bench sound crew there. You know, they're not
really
going to be
cutaways,
the cutaways, the snap of the ball, the line of scrimmage stuff, like all that detail stuff, somebody getting off the line. You know, in the NFL, it was easy to take risks and get really cool shots because you always knew like, oh, one day after this game, we're going to get the NFL films footage.
Well, I mean, I think that applies across the board. You know, we're talking about it, you know, from you at the NFL level, Brock and Justin, you had the same experience at the NFL level. But, you know, I think knowing your purpose and what you're shooting is key. And it applies, you know, from that level, from the highest of highs at NFL films, when you got, you know, 50 Amiras on a game down to, you know, when I was at Elon, like I was the Elon University. Well, I was the only camera there for Elon University. So like, you know, I knew I could maybe steal a high cam from the other team if I was a visitor, and then like it was whatever I got. And, you know, especially, you know, I think I've seen some of Zach's posts before, and, you know, he's talked about, you know, maybe some of the resource challenges he has. And I think it still applies where even with limited cameras at an event, you know, just know what you're prioritizing. You really have to just kind of plan and think about, you know, put a plan in place of, you know, what do I want to capture from the game? What is the most important thing I can get that will help me in the future? And what do I have to sacrifice to get there? Because when you're at that level and when you have resource challenges, you know, that we've all worked with throughout our careers, you have to realize there's going to be a sacrifice to get what you want. And you have to figure out what am I willing to give up and what is the most important part. Like, I just think that's the key thing that applies at every level is just plan and strategize. And from there, then you can kind of start to work with parameters of what other things can I bring in? You know, is there a melt? Is there a TV partner that'll send me stuff? Can I reach out later to the other team and see if they'll send me their down angle and their up angle? Just the strategy side of it and the pre-production planning will go so far in, you know, helping determine what that's going to look like on a game day for you as a shooter. And again, that applies, you know, NFL Films is pre-planning their butt off. And even at the, you know, the lower levels, the mid-majors, the FCS, the D3 levels, wherever you guys are, that pre-planning will go a long, long way to making your lives a hell of a lot easier when you get to game day.
Yeah, and to that point, take risks. You know, when you're shooting, you absolutely need to take a risk. And whether you feel like you can't take that risk because you can't miss what's going on, you're not getting, you can play it too safe, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, get what you can. We all have, the games all last for, you know, at least 30, 45 minutes, right? For the most part, depending on how, what kind of game it is and different quarters and all of that. So maybe you shoot normal for the first quarter and start pushing it in the second quarter. Obviously, different sports, you know, baseball is much different than soccer. If you miss a goal, it's hard. But, you know, if you're shooting tight and the person kicks it and you go, oh no, I can't, I don't know that I'm going to be able to follow that ball, or you do go to follow it and you can't even find it, then, you know, tilt up and ISO the person who took the shot, and you're going to get a reaction from them. There's different ways to go about it, but I always highlight taking risks and pushing your limits, because shooting tight is by far the hardest part to do. So if you can shoot tight and still pull focus and get a good shot, those are the shots that are going to stand out in a piece.
The other thing I'll say, and it's tough, especially lower budget schools, programs,
Yeah, it's assuming good equipment too,
right?
Like the right equipment.
The thing that immediately takes me out of a piece is when I see like somebody on like a 70-200 and they snap zoom out on like a photo lens, right? And try to follow and zoom with a photo lens, because that's really tough to do. it's never going to be as smooth as you want it to be in your head. And again, I'm going to get a little technical here, but it's important. So photo lenses, like an L-series Canon glass, are very focal lenses versus something like a broadcast lens with a, on like a B4 and a zoom rocker, or a, like a PL Cine zoom lens, are parfocal. And what that means is if you ever shot an ENG or a broadcast camera, you zoom in, you grab focus, and you zoom out, and that point you focused on is still in focus,
still in
right?
Focus, yep.
So you can zoom, and only focus if the object is moving towards or away from you, right? And you can be very smooth, smooth with that, even if you're not using a zoom rocker, right?
As long as the subject's not moving.
Right. Well, I mean, you can still pull focus right at you, left away, and get good at that. Whereas on a very focal lens, like a 7200 Canon L series, your focus when you're at 200 millimeters and then you zoom out to 70 millimeters is going to change because it's extremely expensive. It has more glass elements to make a lens parfocal, right? And most photographers don't need parfocal lenses because they're using autofocus, you know, things like that. And the zoom isn't built to be smooth because, again, it's built to be a photo lens. It's not built to capture while zooming. So if you have an L-series lens, at least your aperture isn't going to change. But if you have a lens that has an aperture range on it where it changes based on the focal length, you're going to see flashes or hiccups, and it's going to get darker when you zoom in and brighter when you zoom out. You know, my plea to people shooting on photo lenses is, pick a focal length and go with it, right? You know, take a risk. If you need to be wider, then shoot wider. But I think 9 times out of 10, your zoom is not going to look as good as you want it to, right? As it would with a very focal, or with a parfocal lens. With that said, there's a lot of really affordable older broadcast lens out there that are B4 mount that you can adapt to a lot of different cameras. And just because it's an older lens, or it's a broadcast lens, or it's meant for a 1/3 inch camera, doesn't mean it's going to look bad. NFL Films to this day still shoots with a ton of B4 broadcast lens that they adapt and blow up to fill a Super 35 sensor, right? And they don't do it because that glass is like, oh, the best glass in the world. They do it because they can shoot better on it. It's easier to shoot sports on it. So next time you're looking at a lens, you know, for a couple $1,000s, you can probably find something and adapt something to your camera that can give you, you know, that parfocal range you're looking for with a zoom rocker.
Seems like a good segue to get into specific video cameras. We have the Centerline of Canon that we shoot on, and we do have a couple of those zooms that run about 5K. They have a 18 to 55 and a 70 to 200 with the zoom rocker on there that still, you know, are a better option than photo, especially for game action and all that, without going all the way up to some of their options that are much higher in the 20K range.
Especially in basketball, you know, where you're on a court, right, with a smaller footprint than a football field, you can definitely get away with that 70 to 200, or, you know, put a 1.5 or 1.7 or 2x or whatever it is that Canon, you know, makes with that. Whereas football, you know, that's the problem with football. You're going to be stretched without getting into higher price lenses. And that's the unfortunate nature of sports being played on a wide open 100-yard field. Same with soccer too, right? You're really going to be stretched. But basketball, you can get away with a lot of nicer, shorter lenses like that. That'll allow you to get far and near and get wide enough on the near side, right? That's the other side of football, especially if you're rocking a photo lens. You put something on that has the reach you want, but somebody runs up to you and, you know, you're either flipping off an extender or you're just out of range on a photo lens and that sort of stuff. I've been pretty fortunate in my career to work with some really nice cameras. At the Chiefs, we bought the Aria Miras right when they came out, because we knew NFL Films was moving to them, and we had Panasonic 2000s, the HP 2000s, were they HP or HV? I don't remember. But they're the 2000 P2 card cameras that were end of life, and our budget cycle was up for them. The nice thing is those cameras new cost about what an Aria Mira did. So it was very easy to make the business case and say, oh, well, we're just spending the same money we spent 8 or 9 years ago or whatever that depreciation schedule was. And we got to spend it on Aria Miras, which was fantastic. The Aria Mira is the best camera I've personally ever used. I loved it. We used them at Notre Dame as well. I will say though, I don't think it's worth it. And the reason being, because is, let's just say a base Ari Amira with what you want on it license wise and everything is probably around $40,000, right? I'm just rounding it. There's options you can get 4K, whether you're not, whatever you license wise, it's from 30 to like $50,000. So right in the middle, $40,000. I love Blackmagic's Ursa line and their Ursa Mini G2. They're 4.6K. I personally just bought a Pocket 6K for myself because I love it so much. There is not a $30,000 difference between the image out of the Blackmagic Ursa Mini G2 and the Aria Mira. Now, there's definite build quality differences. The Ursa Mini G2 is plastic, right? It's plastic in a lot of places, whereas the Ari is like all metal. The Ari has better mounting points and it's better weight on your shoulder. It's a better sensor. You know, I'm not going to sit here and argue that the Blackmagic is a better sensor, but that sensor cut together extremely well with our Ari footage, better than any of our Sonys did. Better than basically anything I've seen. It was able to cut together well with it, and it just made me sit back and go, wow, I don't know if there's an $30,000 image difference in these cameras. On top of that, working with students and younger professionals, the Ursa Mini G2 was easy to teach people because it had a touch screen. I could teach people, hey, if you need to change the light balance, just click here. If you need to change the ISO, just click here. Whereas, again, I honestly thought when I first started shooting Aria, I was really intimidated because I thought to myself, oh man, this is a cinema camera. The settings are going to be way too in depth for me to understand or comprehend. But honestly, it was easier than shooting an ENG camera. So it's not like the Aria was tough, but still, you were a couple menus deep on some things, you know, where you had to walk people through and kind of teach them. Whereas everything was at your fingertips on the Blackmagic. So I've been pretty sold on Blackmagic's cameras. But again, what you get for that lower price is you get the issues that Blackmagic has, which is their customer support isn't very good. If it breaks on you, they're probably not going to repair it. They're probably just going to tell you to buy another one. It's made of plastic. It's not going to be as durable as, you know, something like the Ari. They could end a life of camera like after 6 months and just come out with a new one and never update yours again. You know, all these issues that you have with Blackmagic products across the board exist. But if you're on a budget and you're trying to get a look that's akin to something Ari would produce, I think it's really, really close.
And, you know, as you come down kind of from that high end, you know, I know, you know, we've got a great mix of people in our channel from that really high end user, you know, down to people who are maybe looking more on the DSLR side. You know, what recommendations do you guys have as far as DSLRs or, you know, maybe a little more budget level cameras for those that can't go, you know, the F55, the Amira, the Blackmagic route?
Yeah. I mean, I love Blackmagic's Pocket, the 4K and the 6K camera. I think the 4K is $1,500 now, and they slashed the 6K price to $2,000. The 4K has a Micro Four Thirds sensor and mount on it, so there's a lot of adaptability and speed booster options there. You can use a ton of different lenses on it. They both have, you know, good IO. You can record to an SSD on either of them, like an external SSD, so your media can be cheap, or you can record to SD cards. I love Sony stuff too. I have two problems with Sony.
Color.
Yes. I hate S-Log. I absolutely hate it. I'm probably just a terrible colorist, right? So like, but I also don't have a ton of time to grade a ton of stuff when I was working in sports, right? So the LUTs I had just looked and worked better on the Blackmagic and the Amira than what I could get out of S-Log 1, 2, 3, whatever version they're on. And two, the menu system is the most complex, convoluted thing in the world. And it's one of those things. I'm sure once you know it, it's fine. Who cares? But I would go from shooting RE and Blackmagic to all of a sudden pulling out the A7S II for something and being like, I don't even know how to change the frame rate on this, and me fumbling with the menus for a couple minutes to try and figure out on set how to change the frame rate or the record format, you know. But Sony makes good cameras. They're affordable. They fly really easily on gimbals, you know, small handheld gimbals. They make a lot of really cheap, affordable, good looking point and shoots too. You know, if you just want something with an integrated lens and a flip up screen to vlog with or whatever, that's kind of what Sony does. And then Canon, I've always loved Canon's color science. It's like the best color sciences in the world. My problem with Canon was always they were lacking on the feature side, right? They were one of the last to integrate slow-mo, raw recording, kind of the stuff that's been standard on cameras for a while. It always felt to me that Canon was kind of begrudgingly coming along with the cinema camera revolution because they had to, because they accidentally invented it with the 5D Mark II. Or was it the Mark I? The 5D Mark I. The Mark II was after that. But the 5D Mark I. And they always, to me, it always feels like they regretted doing that. But I will say the new C line, 300 is a great camera. What's their new higher end cinema camera that's like 16 grand? I can't remember the name of it.
They have they've come out with a C500 Mark II. They have a C700. We have in-house, we have a C300 Mark II, two C200s and a C100 Mark II. So that kind of, like Garrett was asking the question about cost. They are relatively in that same ballpark for cost. You can also look at the 1DX. That's a little bit more expensive, but that's a little bit more of a photo camera that you can also use for video too. And the 5D Mark IV, the later child of what Brock was talking about with the 5D Mark I, can shoot log and has plenty of capabilities, and that's in the $3,000 to $3,500.
And I would push people again, if you need multi-purpose cameras, Canon or Sony is the way to go. If you want to take photo and video, Blackmagic doesn't do photo, right? That's not what it is. But with that being said, like I honestly believe it's better to buy a cheaper camera body and invest in glass and lighting up front and audio, right? Because that's the kind of stuff that can work with any body you get. You know, moving forward, I'd rather buy some lights that are going to last a while, that are in a kit that I can use for anything, learn to light well, learn to record clean, clear audio, because that's the stuff that's going to drive your production level up. Nobody's going to notice that you shot 6K versus 2K on a 1080p web stream, right? Like, story, and on top of that, story drives everything, right? So if you tell a good story with an iPhone, no equipment is going to trump your story, right? But it can enhance it, right? So, you know, make sure you're buttoned up on your piece too and what you're doing.
I'd say the biggest difference between a DSLR and those Cineline cameras is really the audio integration, being able to plug your audio directly into your source so that you have it all in one place. Because I personally just bought a Canon 6D Mark II because I was on a crop sensor before. Now this is full frame and it has autofocus. When I'm shooting video, I can touch the screen and it'll focus on my kid's face, which is remarkable at that price point. All the features are now in lower cost options. It's just a matter of how much you want your audio embedded with your shoot and some of those other things that are of consideration. Obviously, sensor size is a big deal too with crop sensor and full frame. I see a huge difference in what I can capture low light wise and some of those kinds of things. So there's definitely options out there to, depending on what your price point is, to make things happen, at least start. I've been excited, and we could get into codecs and all sorts of other stuff too as you go along. But I've been really excited just to see the how everything has kind of trickled down into the lower budget cameras to be able to produce content. And I think that's a big reason why when you see people coming out of school, they can shoot photos and video, and that's becoming a lot more of a normal skill set. As before, it was kind of one side or the other. It's a little bit more blended now, and I think that's only helped people and pushed the video side of things, because different people have different eyes when they're shooting photos and lets you see differently, and you know, you can really push the envelope that way.
Oh, I was just going to add, I mean, you saw it on the photo side, you know, kind of going back decades ago, the way manual focus on cameras turning into autofocus really opened up the industry, you know, and I think you're going to see some of the same stuff on this video side as autofocus becomes, you know, more normal on these lower end cameras and, you know, the DSLRs. I think it's going to really open up, you know, the industry a little bit to people who are maybe a little more amateur, who are maybe a little less, you know, inclined to do this professionally. You're going to start to see a lot of, you know, a lot of them maybe take up video that hadn't before.
I can say that you captured me getting a job. So thanks to you, I have a photo of me accepting a job on my flip phone when we were riding back from the X Games. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
Yeah, you were sitting in the front seat and I was sitting in the back by myself when Andy called from Illinois and offered me the job. So you took a photo. Yeah. I still have that.
That's awesome. To kind of what I was saying earlier, it's, you know, everyone kind of thinks they're a photographer because they can grab a professional camera, you know, if they even have a cheaper lens with autofocus, like you can make anything look good. And I think to some extent you're going to see that open up in the video world. And obviously there's a little more that goes into video than photos with the motion and needing to track composition rather than just needing to get it for a frame. But I think it's really going to open up this industry a little bit more than people know.
I kind of want to go back to what you just said in a little bit ago, Justin, is, and I'm going to get up on my elitist cinema soapbox here for a hot second.
I thought it was called an Apple box.
My Apple box. I really do not like full frame video. I think, and this is something that's totally going to change generationally. But to me, it's like 24 frames per second versus 60 frames per second in cinema. Something about full frame breaks that wall down for me, whereas Super 35, for whatever reason, and Super 16 look more cinematic to me. Now, that's probably because that's just what I grew up watching, right? Like most things were Super 35, unless you were in an IMAX, you know, and it was truly shot on like IMAX and not up-res'd. But I'll never forget, like, the first time I thought it was so cool that I don't know if you guys remember the FX show Wilfred about the guy in the dog suit. It was shot on a 5D, but it was shot, the 5D was a full frame camera. And I always thought that show looked good, but it always just like looked off to me. And that's when I really learned about the difference between sensor sizes. Now, with that being said, large format sensors are making a huge comeback. Ari has their new large format, and then the 65. The Revenant was shot large format. And I think there's a place for it. I just think that place needs to be from a story driven perspective, if that makes sense. Like, I think it worked really, really well in The Revenant to show openness and isolation and get depth of field on wider shots that you normally couldn't get. I'm not saying it was totally story driven there. But with that being said, just shooting on the biggest sensor because it's what you have doesn't always, in my opinion, make for the best, most cinematic images. Now, again, that's all subjective. Plenty of people are totally going to disagree with me. Don't at me. I don't want to hear it. These are my opinions. And
this is all constructive conversation.
I like them. But yeah, something about full frame video that I'm sure I'll get over the more I see large format in movies and in TV. But for me, just something about, just give me a, I don't care about losing a little bit of the image. Just resolve me to a Super 35 sensor. Something about the depth of field. It's, you know, it's just looks more cinematic to me.
Yeah, I mean, all the Centerline cameras are crop sensored, right?
I don't like that word, crop censored. It's not, it's Super 35. It's not cropped. It's just Super 35. It is cropped, but but it's not like photo, like an APS-C or whatever, you know, sensor that is truly crop. It's close to Super 35, but that's not a Super 35 sensor.
Okay, we'll go with your Super 35. So since they're all Super 35, that's still a big change from the two-thirds bayonets that we shot on. So we had a...
That's a good correction. I think I said one-third inch sensor earlier.
Well, they have... I mean, there's one-third, but...
There are one-thirds, but most broadcast, real broadcast cameras are two-thirds inch.
Yeah, so we shot and we bought a Sony X500 a handful of years ago because we were still shooting E&G style on the court, and obviously... when you're running gun, and like you guys mentioned with the basketball court, you're on one side and then you're near side. Mm-hmm. So you need that length. And we got it was one of the first cameras that I had seen that we could shoot 60p. And then we also were able to get, up to 120 frames a second. So it was a E&G camera that allowed us to shoot, both sides of the court, shoot 60p, and then also slow-mo, on the fly if we wanted to, different parts of the game and all that. So that to me was really cool. But the biggest difference between that and the Super 35 is the sensor size is so much more, right? So you're going to let in so much more light that mm-hmm. that's going to impact a lot of your controls, and you have to solve for that by, you know, stopping down on the f-stop or you know, upping the shutter speed a little bit or something along those lines to help compensate for that extra light that you're bringing in. So I think maybe that's what you're getting at with the full frame, is that it's letting in so much light that you have to do other things to compensate to still expose the image correctly.
I remember being in college and being so obsessed. This was before affordable cinema cameras, the 5D hadn't came out yet, but we were just so obsessed with getting cinema lenses or cinematic shallow depth of field. That Kevin Brebner, Matt Turner, and myself bought a Super 35 lens adapter, like a Brevis or a Lettuce. We had a Brevis. But if you remember, back before there were affordable cinema DSLRs, you would take this, it was this tube looking thing, and you would screw it on the front of your camcorder or your prosumer 2/3 inch camera. And there was a piece of ground glass in the middle of it. And you would shoot the Handycam or the prosumer camera, like an HPX 200 or whatever, and focus on the ground glass. And then you would never touch that focus again. And then you would put your photo lens or your cinema lens or whatever, on the front of the Brevis adapter, and you'd flip a little switch that would vibrate the ground glass in the middle. And the lens would project its image on that ground glass, and then you would shoot that ground glass to give yourself photo lenses. Well, there are a couple problems with it. A, you lost a ton of light because you weren't just going through one lens. You were going through two lenses plus like some weird glass in the middle of it all. And two, if you didn't have a fancy one, which I did not, the image was upside down because there was nothing to flip it. So it would project upside down. So some of the more expensive ones had mirrors on it that would flip it for you. So we had to like mount a monitor upside down to shoot on it, and it looked terrible. But it was worth it. Because we really, really, really wanted that, you know, cinema level look without buying what was the only real digital cinema camera on the market at the time, which was the Red One, which was extremely expensive at the time.
I think that's what I love about, you know, talking equipment and looks and things like that. There are so many creative ways to do this kind of stuff, right? Like, it goes beyond equipment. I know we're talking equipment and that's the priority, but like, if you get creative with what you're doing, there's a lot of really cool things that you can do. And Brock, like, I just remember, you know, even back in college, to your point, like, that's something that I always appreciated. And thought you were good at, was just finding ways to get the shot that you wanted and the look you wanted, and you just piecemealed something together, but the end result was usually pretty cool, or at the very least, it was unique.
Unique, that's a good word.
It was interesting.
Yeah, and so to your point, Garrett, I think that's a big thing with understanding the exposure triangle, right? Is once you understand the benefits and all the different parts of the triangle and what you want to focus on to tell your story, then you can push those creative limits and try and make the story really stand out by using your creative functions and capabilities because you understand what each one's strengths are.
Yeah, that was always step one for me. You know, when I was training new students at the University of Minnesota or at Elon or wherever, you know, teach them the exposure triangle if they don't know it, because knowing why you're changing a setting and what look you're going to get out of it is like, I mean, that's the building block of anything you're going to do with your equipment is knowing why you're changing your exposure and your settings. From there, you know, what you can do with it is pretty unlimited.
And that can all transfer, right? From whether you're shooting on a DSLR all the way up to Brock's Amira. So I think that's probably a good place to wrap this up, and hope we didn't go too far into the weeds for everybody. But if so, hit us up and let us know if this was helpful or not, and we'll keep on going here. Oh, we didn't even get into YDR.
Oh, dude, I could talk for hours if you can tell.
We shoot almost everything on YDR.
Sure, why not? Future-proof yourself, even if you're not delivering HDR.
Except for game footage, we shoot Rec. 709.
You bake Rec. 709 in?
Yeah.
Oh man, I never break Rec. 709 in.
It's just too the having to turn around content right away at the end of the night. That's
the beauty though of the Amira. For whatever reason, there's some metadata that comes in with the Amira into Premiere that automatically applies the LUT. So it's great. So it comes in, it already has a Rec. 709 conversion on it, but if you go into Lumetri and you just want to tweak a little bit, you're tweaking the log.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, we've talked about shooting YDR and then just having a baked out LUT that you just throw over the top as an adjustment layer in Premiere, but it's just hard to add that rendering to the end of it when you're turning around the report that you do in 75 minutes and then taking 20 minutes to render isn't the most ideal, especially at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. We do 709 for all of our like features and interview shoots and stuff like that. We only do log or whatever, for if we're doing like games, we send our games out for color, but everything else we do in house, and we just don't have time to turn around color on the features. But games, since we send them out of house for color, we don't mind. We'll shoot those in log.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives there. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us your 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. And remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.